Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.
Hey, it's Kim Masters, host of The Business at KCRW. We're going to start the podcast in just a few seconds, but first I want to ask you for your support. You are listening to this podcast for free, but guess what? It's not free to produce. So if you enjoy the show, please send us some support. Send us $10 by texting KCRW to the number 20222. One more time, text KCRW to the number 20222. Thanks so much, and here's the show. From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
I am small. I was always the smallest kid in the class. And, you know, and so here's this geeky, you know, cerebral scientist who was able to kick ass in his alter ego of the Hulk. I really related to that.
Gail Ann Hurd is a true geek who turned her early love of comics, sci-fi, and horror into a spectacular producing career. Her favorite project to date is the hit TV series The Walking Dead. And later in the show, cocaine, diamonds, and a Russian oil baron, the sleazy backstory of two producers on the new Mark Wahlberg film, Lone Survivor. But first on the Hollywood News Banter, is a film's accuracy or lack thereof an issue when it comes to awards? Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I'm joined by my partner in banter, John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. Hello, John.
Hello, Kim.
So, John, we're in the thick of awards season. The Academy Award nominations are coming out in a short time. One of the things that we've, I think, both noticed this awards season is, A, there's a lot of movies, a great number of movies that are based on real stories, and B, whether they're even based on real stories or not, there is like a fact-checking process that goes on where all these people who have issues, more or less valid, about how accurate and truthful are these movies, are sort of out there venting their points of view.
Yeah, it's a lot like a political campaign where you would see a commercial go on TV and you would have news organizations kind of pick it apart, kind of rate it for its accuracy. Now it's a lot of other news organizations and I think kind of maybe competing film studios. We should say that it's right now a very level playing field. I think there's no clear front runner, and the movies have been judged on their merits, on their artistic execution. Now the second or third wave of the examination is how truthful or factual are they? And as you mentioned, there's a lot of movies that are based on true stories. Wolf of Wall Street, American Hustle, Saving Mr. Banks, Captain Phillips, 12 Years a Slave. And people are looking very closely at where these filmmakers are departing from the true story. And the question is, do those departures kind of make the true story submerge? In other words, are they telling a version of the truth that is not really truthful?
I do think there, even with movies that aren't based on true events, I mean, we had a lot of scientists analyzing how accurate the depiction of space was in Gravity. And I don't really think that kind of argument gets a ton of traction. I think where there's a traction problem is with something like Saving Mr. Banks, for example, where they're sort of trying to present a story of real conflict between the author of Mary Poppins and Walt Disney as somehow a catharsis story in which the author of Mary Poppins comes to terms with the loss of her father because of the process of making Mary Poppins, which is kind of fabricated. And I think it sort of clanks with people who are just not comfortable with that kind of version of an event.
I think the same could be said about Captain Phillips. There are little departures, little kind of embellishments. Maybe there's compressed characters. Maybe there's a slight change in the chronology. But I would argue with Saving Mr. Banks and Captain Phillips, they do preserve the kind of core story. The real question, I think, is when you exclude things that are material to the story. And I think this is where Wolf of Wall Street is kind of the central argument in this. What are you leaving out, and are you missing the overall story that is much more important than the thing you're choosing to tell?
Now, of course, this is Martin Scorsese's film about this con man, Jordan Belfort, and his colleagues and how they ripped people off and, you know, just complete decadent sex and drugs and rock and roll. And the problem with the film is this is not something that happened 100 years ago. So there are people who were involved in this, hurt by this scheme that this guy ran. And some of these people are speaking up and saying, what about the victims? And Scorsese and Leo DiCaprio and Jonah Hill and everybody involved with the film has sort of been deployed like a firefighting squad to put out this raging question about what about the victims and does it glorify these guys? And somehow or another, I think the problem is that their argument that it doesn't really convince.
No, and I think the real issue is if you don't control the narrative, if the story about the factual departures become the story about the film, then you have the risk that Zero Dark Thirty went through last year, where the story about whether or not the film falsely depicted the role that enhanced interrogations or torture played in locating Osama bin Laden, that becomes the story about the movie rather than its artistic accomplishments. So if the story about Wolf of Wall Street is about why they didn't depict the victims as opposed to the artistic merits of the film, that movie, I think, is going to have a very hard time with Oscar voters in the weeks ahead.
I think it's a really apt analogy to Zero Dark Thirty because you're putting Academy members and other voters who on awards into a position of possibly feeling that they're voting for a morally dubious film. And that, I think, is exactly what you're saying, is where the real problems begin and it becomes not about the merit. Now, meanwhile, there's another dilemma which has arisen in the context of awards campaigning, which is whether or not a critic's tweet can be used to promote a film. And I'm specifically talking about New York Times critic A.O. Scott, Tony Scott, as he is also known. He wrote a tweet about the film Inside Llewyn Davis from the Coen brothers. And that became the basis for a full-page ad, just that tweet, a full-page ad in the New York Times.
I mean, there's a long history of movie studios taking quotes out of context in reviews. I think the difference here is not only did they kind of alter the tweet, but they used a tweet. And more important, Tony Scott was asked by CBS Films and the film's producers, including Scott Rudin, whether or not they could use the tweet. And Tony Scott specifically said, and I'm quoting now, "Changing the tweet is basically manufacturing a quote, something I avoid. So I'm afraid the answer is no," unquote. And that's not exactly what the studio heard.
Yeah, I mean, I do actually have some feeling about devil's advocates in this, in that I feel that if you tweet something, that is a very public forum, and to somehow claim that it is private or shouldn't be used is a little bit, I think, naive. But they did ask him, and he did say no. Now, let me just tell you what he tweeted versus what they used, and we can talk about whether or not it's materially different. His tweet was, "You all keep fighting about Wolf of Wall Street and Am Hustle, obviously American Hustle. I'm going to listen to the Llewyn Davis album again, Fare Thee Well, My Honeys." And I should say also that he has listed this as, you know, I think his favorite film of the year. Now, the version that appeared in the ad was just, "I'm going to listen to the Llewyn Davis album again, Fare Thee Well, My Honeys." So it's just the tail end of the tweet. However, I have to say, I don't think it materially changes the meaning of the tweet. And again, can't believe I'm saying this, but I feel it's kind of public, and therefore asking him and then ignoring his request is one thing, but a tweet to me is a public thing.
Yeah, and I think it means a lot of journalists, a lot of critics are going to be even more careful about what they say, because if it happened to Tony Scott in the New York Times, it's going to happen to everybody at some other location.
And by the way, so they should be careful, because again, anyone can read a tweet. We've seen any number of people get into huge amounts of trouble over tweets, lose their gigs over tweets. So, you know, this is not a private conversation in somebody's living room. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Kim.
That's John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. Coming up later in the show, the journalist who uncovered the sordid history of two producers behind Mark Wahlberg's Lone Survivor. But first, how a geeky little girl became a powerful Hollywood producer. Gail Ann Hurd may not be a household name, but she is one of Hollywood's power players. Her company, Valhalla Motion Pictures, produces the giant hit TV series The Walking Dead, which regularly draws more than 10 million viewers. Hurd is an industry veteran who got her start in the 70s working for the king of B-movies, Roger Corman. It was then that she met her former husband, James Cameron, and for years she produced his movies, the Terminator series, Alien, and The Abyss. After she and Cameron split in 1989, Hurd went on to make other sci-fi and horror films, including two about the Incredible Hulk. as executive producer on The Walking Dead and a self-described godmother of the show, she's weathered a lot of change over the past four seasons. There have been controversial showrunner firings, starting with the abrupt dismissal of Frank Darabont, her friend and the original creator of the television series. Michael Schneider, the LA bureau chief of TV Guide magazine and host of our monthly TV podcast, The Spinoff, recently met with Hurd in her offices. She told him that back when she first read the Robert Kirkman comic book, she tried to get the rights, but found that Darabont had them. He'd shopped the project around town without success and had lost interest. But Hurd was persistent.
I called up Frank, and he said, "Been there, done that, not interested." And I said, "Well, if I call you back and say that there is a place that is interested, would that change your mind?" And he said, "Absolutely." And the next phone call was to Robert Kirkman and Dave Alpert to find out where the rights were. And there was someone else who was in the midst of negotiating for the rights. Mm. So that had to play out. We did have an opportunity, though, to sit down with Robert at Comic-Con that summer. And, you know, we said, "Listen, we'd love to go forward with this if it turns out that the other deal didn't work out." And when the other deal didn't work out, we had a very receptive network in AMC, and it was actually the fastest from pitch to green light in my career.
What was it about it that you thought this? I would like to be involved with this.
Well, first of all, I'm a horror and genre fan from the time that I was little, long before it was popular to be a nerd or a geek, and secondly, I tend to go back to mine the same scenario over and over again, which is ordinary people thrust into extraordinary circumstances and how they handle it. Now, that could be Sarah Connor in The Terminator, Ellen Ripley in Aliens, Bud and Lindsay Brigman in The Abyss. You know, our cast of characters in Armageddon tend to return to that same theme.
Right, right.
And that's very much the case in The Walking Dead. These are ordinary people. These aren't superheroes. And, you know, and every decision they make is ultimately life or death.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the great things about being the number one show on TV is that there's so much attention toward the show, so much press attention, so much media attention. But it also means when there's a showrunner change, there's also a lot of media attention, a lot of people asking, "What's up? Why do they keep changing showrunners? Why has this happened twice now?"
That's not something that those of us who are part of the producing team were involved in. Certainly with Glenn, that it was certainly an amicable parting of the ways. From what I heard, there was a difference in vision in what he proposed for the upcoming season. With Frank, I think that was a much bigger shock to all of us. Was in the middle of a season.
Yeah, and he's said some things recently because he's been out promoting his new show where he hasn't watched the show since. It seems like
there's no way that he could.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Frank is a dear, close friend of mine, and I think Mob City is fantastic. So anyone who hasn't watched it absolutely should. But in terms of what exactly happened, that's something that Frank and AMC know.
Have you and Frank stayed in touch? Are you?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I went to, you know, we're always going to be close friends, and it was very important to those of us who are still on the show that it's with Frank's blessing.
Yeah, and he still has a credit. You still see
his
name.
Yes, he does.
So I mean, he was there at the beginning. So, let's talk about you. I mean, take me back to your origins as this young geek girl. You know, there are a lot of geek girls out here now, but back then, it wasn't all that cool.
It was a lonely place to be. I lived in Los Angeles up until the time that I was 10, and then we moved to Palm Springs. And while I was living in Palm Springs, an older brother, 9 years older, he loved comics. So I would get his cast-off comics. I was very much a Marvel girl, although I did like the darker Batman from the DC world. That's where I became a huge Hulk fan. I love Fantastic Four. And I think I related to the Hulk because I am small. I was always the smallest kid in the class. And, you know, and so here's this geeky, you know, cerebral scientist who was able to kick ass in his alter ego of the Hulk. I really related to that.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. Today, Michael Schneider, host of our TV podcast, The Spinoff, is talking with Gail Ann Hurd, producer of The Walking Dead. Her long history in show business started in the 70s when she worked with Roger Corman. At the time, the king of B-movies had a mini-studio cranking out low-budget genre films.
Your career path is astounding. I mean, going way back to when you and Jim were pushing Terminator and sort of, you know, trying to get this thing to happen. And you know, you became, what do they call you, the first lady of sci-fi? Do you like that title, by the way?
I love it. I love it because I remember when I was growing up in junior high and high school, people made fun of me. I mean, I was, you know, I wore glasses. I was the nerd. There wasn't even a term nerd then. You know, I was the unpopular, awkward, uncoordinated kid that was chosen last for every sports team. And I would be sitting there reading comic books, reading science fiction. And, you know, and it transported me to these amazing worlds. And now to be able to bring those worlds to life, you know, that's one of those dreams you can never imagine, especially a girl back in the 60s and early 70s. You know, and I was just so lucky to have been able to work for Roger Corman, who was the only person at the time who was empowering women. And the first film that I worked on, Humanoids from the Deep, was directed by a woman. And that was, you know, the late 70s. Unheard of.
What do you think it was about Roger that he was so sort of at the forefront of, you know, giving these opportunities to women in Hollywood?
Well, I think one thing is that his wife, Julie Corman, isn't given enough credit. She was always strong, a visionary. Roger very much believed in her and her abilities, as well as Barbara Boyle, who was the chief operating officer at New World Pictures, which is the company that Roger formed. And he was really always surrounded by strong, powerful women who made things happen and were willing to work harder for less money and were more loyal. So as far as he was concerned, that was the trifecta.
What's interesting is looking at some clips, there was a 1994 New York Times profile of you, and it was headlined, "A Woman Making Movies for Men."
Well, and the funny thing is, of course, is that the films that I make and the TV series has almost 50-50 male-female. It's the perception of the media and the perception actually of culture that these sci-fi, fantasy, and horror films only appeal to men. And that couldn't be less true.
Right.
In fact, slasher films, the primary audience opening night are teenage girls.
You mentioned in a recent interview, I'm going to quote you here, you said the rules are different for women than they are for men. Elaborate a little bit on that and what that meant.
Well, you know, I think we've seen that not only in my business, but all businesses.
Sure.
If you've read Sheryl Sandberg and Nell Scovell's Lean In, it's the same in my business.
Yeah.
It's the same in entertainment. If you're strong and have a vision and insist on your vision, you know, you're a ball buster, you're a bitch. And if you're a guy, you're a visionary. It's socioculturally a different world when you're a woman. Yet at the same time, if you're not able to communicate a vision, if you're not able to inspire people, but also make those tough phone calls, like telling someone, you know, that their character is going to be killed off, then you're never going to be a leader. And, you know, then it's, oh, well, a woman can't do that job. So you're pretty much, you know, damned if you do, damned if you don't. And I made a decision early on, which is another thing that when reading Lean In, I realized was an important crossroads for me. I decided that I had a choice. I could be liked or I could be respected. And I couldn't be both. And I chose to be respected.
And obviously the proof is in the pudding and the fact that you've had the success that you've had.
You know, and at this point, you know, I've been elected to the board of the Motion Picture Academy by my branch, by the producers branch. I serve as an officer of the Producers Guild. And, you know, so I think at the end of the day, it was making the decision to be respected has worked out really well.
That was Michael Schneider, host of our monthly TV podcast, The Spinoff, talking with Walking Dead producer Gail Ann Hurd. Coming up after a short break, cocaine, diamonds, and Russian oil money aren't the subject of a new movie. They're part of the backstory of two shadowy Hollywood producers.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. There's a long history of sketchy people with money from mysterious sources coming into Hollywood to finance movies. That still goes on today, as an article just published in the LA Weekly illustrates in unusual detail. Written by Gene Mattis, who normally covers local politics and crime, this article tells the story of two recently minted producers, Stefan Martirosian and Remington Chase, which is, as you might suspect, an assumed name. Chase is a Los Angeles native. Martirosian is an Armenian who eventually emigrated to the U.S. While Chase claims to have had a career as a child actor, neither he nor Martirosian had any real history in the movie business before they burst onto the Hollywood scene in 2011. The pair has financed a dozen films over the past 2 years, the most recent being Lone Survivor, directed by Pete Berg and starring Mark Wahlberg.
Hey, eyes down. Eyes down. Eyes down. Eyes down.
Danny, you radio working?
Feeling like a cursed op.
Not a cursed op. No curses. It's just Afghanistan. That's all.
As Mattis reveals in his LA Weekly story, both Chase and Martirosian have been arrested on cocaine trafficking charges in separate stings and both spent a number of years in prison. Criminal associates have accused them of being involved in the African diamond trade and even alleged that they ordered a hit on a Russian businessman who was, in fact, murdered. The two have denied any involvement with diamonds or a murder scheme, and both claim they weren't even involved with drugs, even though they both pled guilty to drug offenses. Notwithstanding his checkered past, for 15 years, Martirosian has worked in the U.S. as the representative of a Russian oil man named Vitaly Grigoryants. For a while, Martirosian oversaw a number of money-losing real estate investments for the Russian, but 2 years ago, he and Chase turned up in Hollywood, announcing a multi-million dollar film fund. They had decided, as Martirosian told journalist Gene Mattis, that putting money into the movie business was better than dealing with the uncertainty of real estate. Still, Hollywood hasn't exactly proved a moneymaker for them, at least not yet. When they sat down with Mattis in a Santa Monica restaurant, they said that so far, they've lost about $50 million.
To me, that is a pretty startling admission by itself. I don't think you hear people admitting that they lost money in the movie industry very often.
So they actually are learning about the movie business. Martirosian says in your story, they were talking about this movie, Broken City, I believe,
yeah,
which lost money. We were shocked, actually, he says. We had three great stars, Russell Crowe, Catherine Zeta-Jones, and Mark Wahlberg. The movie tanked. Very frustrating.
Yeah, and so they were saying, okay, we in the past have trusted the people that we were in business with, and we're not doing that anymore. We're going to be very hands-on from now on. A to Z, we want to see the script, and we want to talk to the stars, and we want to talk to the director and everything, and we want to know exactly everything that's going on in our movie. Whether that means they'll make any more money on anything in the future is sort of up to be determined, I guess.
Well, so you say that they have among their movies in development two that are based on Hasbro board games, Monopoly and Hungry Hungry Hippos.
Yeah.
I don't know that game, but I'm sure it's great.
And I think it was big in the 80s.
Okay. And I am wondering, did you check in with Hasbro? Like, do you know who you're in business with, or did you make that effort, or did you just figure whatever?
That was not a call that I made. They clearly are in business with Hasbro, and Hasbro made an announcement about it. And, you know, it's sort of up to Hasbro to decide whether they want to continue to be in business with them or not.
Right. So they are supposedly on this learning curve and continue to have money to spend. But again, just to make it clear, the actual source of this money is somewhat murky. Which would be more accurate, somewhat or totally?
somewhat murky. I mean, we know who the principal person is.
You know, you mean you were talking about the oil man, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. And he was also involved in banking and real estate in Russia and had a string of gas stations in the Ukraine. And so the guy is, you know, a known entity in Russia. But, you know, in terms of precisely, you know, where does the money come from, I think that's a little murky.
So now I'm going to get to this incredible, intricate story and how it came to your attention.
I got a tip sometime in November that there's this guy, Martirosyan, who's making movies, and he spells his name S-Y-A-N. And there's another guy, Martirosyan, who spells it S-I-A-N, who was convicted of cocaine trafficking, and they kind of look similar, their pictures.
And you say in the piece that he had tweaked the spelling of his name in the movie business so that people might be less likely to identify him through a Google search.
Right, and it took actually a couple of weeks of going through property records and so forth to see that these two Martirosyans were the same person.
So you then finally come to sit down with these two. And what do these two guys look like?
They're both in their mid-50s. Remington Chase is sort of heavy set and sort of sandy hair and glasses and kind of very sort of tightly wound. Martirosyan seems a little more casual, a little more charming, a little easier to smile. He's got a big head of black hair, and he's sort of wearing a leather jacket and turtleneck, and a big black watch. They sort of had this interesting contrast in that, you know, one's from Armenia and one's from LA. And I mean, I think they knew that I knew a lot about their criminal backgrounds.
You had told them that.
I had met first with Grant Kramer, who's their partner, and I had told him, look, I want to do a story about Chase and Martirosyan. And I have this information about their backgrounds, and I would like to get some input from them in terms of how they, you know, see that information and how they would like that handled.
And they bring along a PR person.
Yeah. We had set up this interview for a Thursday afternoon, and the Wednesday night I get an email from this publicist saying, okay, well, these guys have contacted me, and they want me to come along, and, they want me to help them do this interview. And I mean, the first thing I thought was, oh, she's probably just going to cancel the interview. But she didn't. She came along and she sat through the whole thing. And, I think she got to know her clients a little bit better through the course of the interview.
So if you're a Hollywood publicist and you're called in and suddenly you're hearing all of this stuff involving, you know, alleged murderers and cocaine busts and black diamonds, what do you do?
I mean, her reaction was, well, we can't have any of this in the newspaper. I mean, this is horrible. This is not, in the typical publicist relationship, I think the publicist would have a lot more say-so over whether this stuff is going to be in the story or not. In this situation, we're dealing with public records. We're dealing with a bunch of, you know, documented stuff that I'm just asking them for their side of the story on. So it's not like they had any control over whether I was going to do a story or not.
So Chase says to you, and as you're sitting there at the Earth Cafe in Santa Monica, you're going to destroy relationships, you're going to destroy families, you're going to destroy jobs for people, and countless motion pictures,
yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So do you feel that you have actually done those things?
Not yet, but it's still early.
do you feel a pang of guilt about the countless motion pictures that you may have destroyed?
The Hungry, Hungry Hippo movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if that's going to weigh heavily on my conscience if they don't make the Hungry, Hungry Hippo movie. No, I mean, I think, you know, obviously these guys did what they did and they are who they are, and we just reported the truth about them. And if that causes repercussions for them, that's kind of out of my hands, you know. And, you know, I think at the end of the day, they still are willing to put up money to make movies. And I assume that somehow some way will be found for them to keep investing if they want to.
Gene Mattis is a staff writer for the LA Weekly. We've been discussing his article, Drugs, Diamonds, International Intrigue. You Won't Believe Two Hollywood Producers' Crazy Backstory. And thank you so much for coming in.
No, thank you for having me.
A Postscript, Howard Weitzman, an attorney for Chase and Martirosyan, recently told The Hollywood Reporter that their company has not experienced any negative feedback from Mattis' article and added they intend to continue their involvement in the production of great films. To read the article, go to kcrw.com/thebusiness. And that's The Business. Darby Maloney produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can listen to us anytime on demand with the KCRW smartphone apps, and you can hear the podcast on iTunes, TuneIn, and wherever you download podcasts. The show is produced and distributed by KCRW. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.